and took a few steps forward, reaching out for me. I took a few steps back in response. He pulled his hat off and blinked at the sun in his eyes.
Okay. Just give me a few minutes. My other clothes are in the pool locker room.
He headed toward the school. I escaped up to the press box where Evan and Ian worked the baseball scoreboard controls and explained to them where Miles was and how I planned on hiding with them for the entire game.
Isn't this your old school? Evan asked.
I nodded. Unfortunately.
What happened? What got you thrown out?
I spray-painted the word communists on the gym floor. Things got out of hand. I was having a few problems at the time. Everything's fine now.
It's okay, Ian laughed. We don't really care about your problem, I guess is what we're calling it.
Well, that's good. Relief washed through me. I looked over at the Hill Park stands, then back at Evan and Ian, and remembered how much it had sucked the first time, how people hadn't trusted me, how they made fun of the way I spun around every time I entered a room, my incessant picture-taking, and how I hadn't been that lonely since I was 7 years old and my only friend had left me for Germany. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw someone climbing the stairs to the press box. A brown uniform flew up and landed on the scoreboard controls.
"Your Nazi boyfriend won't need that anymore."
I spun, catching a flash of Rhea's blonde hair. I looked down at Miles's uniform, then over at Evan and Ian, and all three of us understood at the same time.
"Theo," Evan called to the concession stand below us, "come up here and run this thing for a second."
The three of us sprinted to the school, each holding a different piece of Miles's uniform. We barreled into the hallways behind the gym, through the locker rooms, and into the connected natatorium. It had finally happened. McCoy had used Cliff and Rhea as a distraction, and Miles was laying on the tiled floor in a puddle of his own blood. The natatorium was dark when we arrived. A lone figure sat on the bench next to the pool, soaking wet and clad in nothing but a pair of boxer shorts.
"Go get towels," I said to Evan and Ian. They vanished into the locker rooms.
I sat down next to Miles. His glasses were missing, and his eyes were unfocused.
"I hate water," he mumbled.
"I know." He looked like a waterlogged cat. His hair was plastered to his head. Goosebumps covered his skin, layered over fading bruises that dotted his torso and ran down along his ribs. A horrible green-yellow-blue one ran diagonally across his back. They were all old, not inflicted here.
"What happened?" I asked.
"I went into the locker room to change," he said. "They ambushed me, took my glasses, threw me in the pool. They were gone by the time I got out, but it was slippery and I fell back in. Now you're here. The end."
He scratched at his legs, his arms, picked at his skin like there was something there. I remembered all the bandages, the smell of pond scum and algae. Animalia and Nelida Hirudinia. Leeches.
"You can't let them do things like this to you," I said.
"It won't be much longer."
He said it softly, his voice like every part of him I'd ever met, the jerk, the 7-year-old, the genius, and none of them, all at the same time. This was something new, something unknown, something that scared me. Maybe he meant it wouldn't be much longer until the end of the school year, that when we were out of high school he'd have more freedom to do what he needed to do.
"Are you sure, idiot? You're so stupid. He never talks about college, or anything after this. Are you really so naive?"
All he wanted, all he knew to do, was to get his mother out of that hospital. But he had to get rid of Cleveland first. He had a plan. I knew that. I hadn't realized how far he was willing to go. Some deep instinct made me reach out and grab his arm, hold it tightly as if I could keep him right where he was, alive and sound. I could not lose him again. No,
I could not let him get lost. I was suddenly more afraid than I had ever been in my entire life. More afraid than when Bloody Miles had shown up at Celia's bonfire. More afraid than when my mother said she would send me away. This was worse than the idea of McCoy trying to hurt Miles. I could stop McCoy. I could yell and scream, and even if they didn't believe me, they would stop and look. I had no sway over Miles himself. Not when it came to this. Evan and Ian returned laden with towels and Miles' school clothes, and Miles dried himself off. Neither of them said anything about the bruises as Miles pulled his pants and shirt on. We followed him out of the natatorium. As we passed the main gym, I heard voices and glanced inside. But only McCoy was there. He paced below the scoreboard, talking aloud like he was gearing up for a big speech. No Celia. No Celia's mother. Fear spiked through me that he was so close, that the only thing separating him from Miles was a closed door. Then the fear was gone again, and McCoy was just a lonely man in a lonely room talking to himself. "What's wrong?" Miles asked. Even if I told him, I wasn't sure he'd understand. "Nothing," I said. "Will he be okay?" "Outlook not so good." "Can I do something to make him okay?" "Very doubtful." "Can I do anything?" "Don't count on it." Chapter 43. I saw what Miles had meant when he'd said people would start paying him to do ridiculous things. In chemistry, someone gave him $30 to call Ms. Dalton a coke-sucking whore in German, which of course she didn't understand. He got $20 to put tape on the bridge of his glasses, wear two short pants, and don argyle socks for 3 days. Cliff, the asshole, paid Miles $50 to be able to deck him in the jaw, and one punch turned into several punches and a kick to the gut. The triplets speculated that Cliff had been aiming for the genitals, but Miles's incessant stare had thrown him radically off target. Every day he threw away another piece of his pride and dignity for a few dollars. But I couldn't stop him. I don't think anyone could have. Chapter 44.
Ridgemont!
Mr. Gunthrey slapped his newspaper down on his desk. Yes, sir.
I'm tired of that damn light flickering.
The light over my desk flickered as he said it, mocking him. Do you want me to do something about it, sir? I asked. I could hardly keep my eyes open. My dreams had been less than restful lately.
I damn sure do. The maintenance men have replaced the light 3 times. Get up there and tell me what it looks like.
I wasn't about to ask him why he didn't just ask the maintenance guys to check. While the rest of the class turned back to their work, I climbed onto my desk and lifted away the ceiling tile next to the light. Putting my hands on either side of the opening and standing on tiptoes, I looked up into the darkness. Something's gnawed on the wiring. I squinted into the dim space, trying to focus on the frayed wire. It hadn't just been gnawed on. It had been completely ripped in two. Something near my head hissed. I turned and saw the python there, its tongue flicking out at me. I rolled my eyes. I didn't have time for this. Damn delusions needed to leave me the hell alone. I ducked my head back down, but kept my hands up for balance. Something touched my arm, but I ignored it. Hey, Miles, you want to give me a boost? I think there are mice or something up here. I might be able to see it better. Miles turned, rose halfway out of his seat, and looked up at me. The snake hissed again. I looked at the snake. I looked at Miles. The snake. Miles. The snake. Miles.
Alex.
He held up a hand.
Don't move.
Several kids screamed. Desks shifted and scraped across the floor as they jumped up and ran from the room. Mr. Gunthrey shot out of his seat, cursing loudly and yelling about snakes and Vietnam. The python coiled down my arm, passed behind my head, and wrapped over my left shoulder and across my chest. It looped itself once around my waist, then down my left leg. Its body spilled out of the ceiling like scaly water, lighter than it looked.
Holy shit.
Miles stood fully now.
Holy shit, Alex. It's the snake.
You can see it? I hissed the words out through my teeth.
Yeah, I can see it.
What do I do?
Let me think.
He pressed his palms to his forehead and spoke rapidly.
They can live over 20 years, feed on large rodents or other mammals, average about 12 feet but can reach 19.
He groaned loudly and spoke even faster.
Trinomial name is Python malorus bivitatus. Can be domesticated, non-venomous, can kill a child when they're young, and crush a full-grown man when they're older.
Miles, shut up! My voice rose an octave, my heart pounding against my ribs. The snake shifted against me. I fought the urge to scream.
Someone call animal control! Theo cried.
No, that'll take too long.
Tucker was suddenly beside me.
It's hungry. Come on, Alex. You have to get down from there.
How do you know it won't...
I shivered as the snake's waving head brushed my calf.
Kill me.
It's hungry, Tucker insisted, avoiding the question. I can help get him off. You have to come down here.
Him?
I squeaked.
Please, please, get down. It's going to be okay.
God, Beaumont, what the hell is wrong with you? Miles shoved Tucker out of the way and held out a hand. I slowly lowered my left hand from the ceiling to reach out and take his. No more facts, I whispered.
No more facts,
Miles agreed.
Go slow. Step down.
I moved slowly. The snake hissed.
Tucker!
I waved my other hand, the one attached to the arm that had the snake's tail wrapped around it. Tucker looked surprised, but took my hand.
Where are we going?
The janitor's closet, he said.
Lead. Lead.
We headed toward the door, passing stunned classmates and a freaked-out Mr. Gunthrie. I crushed their hands. We shambled out into the hallway and toward the stairs.
I think you're breaking my fingers, said Miles.
Shut up.
As we painstakingly descended the stairs, they kept up a steady stream of small talk. We stopped at the bottom and took our time turning, then set off for Tucker's cult in a closet. The snake weighed on me like the heaviest piece of clothing I would ever wear.
So, Miles?
I squeezed his hand harder.
Have I said how much I really don't want to be stuck in Crimson Falls? But I'm pretty sure my mom is going to put me there anyway, and this situation makes me realize the direness of that whole thing.
Crimson Falls? Miles repeated. What's Crimson Falls? God, we were not about to play this game. The psychiatric hospital? Where your mom is?
Alex, the hospital is called Woodlands. Where'd you get Crimson Falls?
I sucked in a breath under the snake's weight, trying to keep calm. That's what the sign out front said. It said Crimson Falls.
The sign in front says Woodlands.
Panic gripped me. Made Miles panic.
Hey, he continued quickly. What'd you do with my Christmas present?
What present?
I breathed out.
The cupcake? I ate it.
No, not the cupcake.
Oh, damn it, I forgot to explain. He flexed his hand in mine.
I left it on your desk before we got out for Christmas break.
The rock? The one that's been sitting in my locker all semester?
Yeah.
That was you.
It's a piece of the Berlin Wall. I thought you'd like it.
I looked over at him, felt the snake constrict again, and could only say,
Shut up.
God, Alex, I am so sorry, Tucker breathed. I never thought this would happen. I thought it would die soon. Do you even have a club in that closet, Beaumont?
Miles growled.
No, of course not. You seriously think I have friends?
Tucker shot him a glare over my head.
You have a club. I have a python. You can stop rubbing it in my face now, all right?
Both of you, shut up!
Somehow we made it to the janitor's closet.
Tucker hurried to the back of the small room and pulled open a freezer. The snake swung its head up, tasting the air. Tucker pulled a whole frozen raccoon from the freezer. He dangled it near the snake and tossed it on the floor. The snake slithered off me. I stumbled back and fell on my butt in the middle of the hallway. Miles backed out of the room and turned to me.
"You gave me a piece of the Berlin Wall?" I whispered.
"What?"
"You gave me a piece of the Berlin Wall?"
"Yeah. Opa gave it to me. I've had it for a really long time, and I thought you'd like..."
"Miles!" I grabbed the front of his shirt and hoisted myself up to his level. "You gave me a piece of the symbol of the downfall of communism in Europe."
Well, yeah.
"Crimson Falls isn't Crimson Falls."
"No, it's..."
"I almost got killed by a fucking snake."
"Yeah."
"I think I'm going to faint." My hands fell away from his shirt. Blood rushed to my head, and the world went black. Chapter 45. I spent the rest of first period and all of second in the nurse's office, watching animal control pass through the hallway. I had to answer a lot of questions, then talk to my dad on the phone. Apparently my mother thought I'd hallucinated the snake, but then she found out half my English class was now paranoid as hell, and the other half was so excited they couldn't stay in their seats. Miles helped Tucker get rid of the snake food fridge, but they refused to tell me exactly how they snuck it out past the teachers and animal control. Miles looked grim. Tucker was sweating. "What'd you have to do, kill someone?" I asked. "Did you have to hide a body, too?" They glanced at each other. Tucker pulled on his collar.
"Not exactly." "Don't worry about it," Miles said at the same time.
I decided to leave that one alone. I went back to class during third period and was bombarded with requests to retell the story. It was so bad that the teacher decided we weren't learning anything and we got a free study period instead. The problem with retelling the story was that it made me relive it, and I didn't want to remember the feeling of coming close to having my ribs crushed. I didn't want to remember how that python had gone from fake to real in 5 seconds. Looking back on an event and realizing how easily you could have died, without even comprehending the deadliness of the thing that killed you, was like getting a bucket of ice water thrown in your face. Mostly harmless, but no less shocking. I spent my lunch period combing my food for poison and thinking about how I could have been gone forever. Poof. Kaput. Forget college. Bye-bye all the other years of my life. I would have died in this lobster tank. Chapter 46. I was working at Finnegan's on Friday when a swarm of East Shoalers stormed the place. Everyone from the club to Cliff and Rhea showed up, cramming every corner of the restaurant. Finnegan himself always stopped by on Friday nights, and this royally screwed me over because I couldn't take pictures or do my perimeter checks or my food inspections. He sat in his office and made sure we were doing what we were supposed to do. He was an average-looking guy, average height, average build, average black-brown hair and gray-blue eyes. He reminded me of a vulture, his neck too long and bent at odd angles. Miles wandered in and took a seat with the rest of the club. Gus slid his burger and fries through the kitchen window before I could ask for it. "Thanks," Miles said when I set the food in front of him. Art and Jetta sat across from him, the triplets at the next table over. "Sorry I can't stay and talk," I said. "Finnegan's here. He'll crucify me if it looks like I'm not working." I tugged on Miles's white shirt sleeve with two fingers as I said it. A sorry replacement for a kiss, but the best I could do under Finnegan's watch.
"Pretend like we're ordering something else," Theo said. "And answer this question. You're going to prom, right?"
Miles rolled a French fry between his thumb and index finger.
No, I can't."
I pulled out my notepad and pretended to write something down. "I have to work that night."
"Oh, but Jetta could make the perfect dress for you," whined Theo. "Please, please go. Ask off work, I did, and I never ask off."
"I really can't, Theo. I'm sorry." I didn't have the money for it, and neither did Miles.
Don't look now, Art whispered. Cliff's giving you the evil eye.
In my peripheral, I noticed Cliff and Rhea staring at me from a few tables over. They can do what they want, I said. They probably just want to make more jokes about me being a snake charmer. I didn't expect anything else from them at this point. After the snake incident, I saw them in the cafeteria reenacting what had happened for their friends. According to them, I'd fainted straight away, and Miles had tried to beat the snake to death while it was still wrapped around me. A-plus performances, really. But if they were going to make fun of my near-death experience, they could have at least gotten the details right. I ignored them and returned to the counter, pretending to look for another notepad, but actually searching for the magic eight ball. Was that snake real every time I saw it, or only sometimes? Were there other things I had thought were hallucinations but were actually real? Even if the answer to that one was yes, it wasn't like the eight ball could tell me exactly what they were. The eight ball's usual spot beside the register was empty. I grabbed Tucker. Hey, where's the eight ball?
What?
The eight ball, Finnegan's magic eight ball, I can't find it. Tucker gave me a weird look, said,
Finnegan doesn't have a magic eight ball,
and hurried off. I stared at the countertop and let that sink in. I'd used the eight ball so many times I couldn't remember all the questions I'd asked it, and I'd never once suspected it of being a hallucination. It didn't even seem like a hallucination. There was nothing strange about it. The blue water wasn't purple or orange or green. It never said strange things. It was just an old magic eight ball, red scuff mark and all. It was just there. I looked up. The restaurant was a living, breathing creature ready to eat me alive. I braced my hands against the edge of the counter and took a few deep breaths.
Alexandra!
Now Finnegan was leaning forward in his computer chair, craning his vulture neck around the office door to see me.
Get back to work.
I scrambled for my water pitcher. Tucker was already going around with the Coke and tea. I nodded as I passed him, refilling drinks on the way. When I stopped at Cliff and Rhea's table, everyone there was strangely cordial to me. I liked it that way. It was like they didn't really notice me. I ignored them, and they ignored me. Good. Until I turned to move on to the next table. My foot caught on something. I stumbled. The water pitcher, after sloshing its contents across my front, caught me in the jaw. Pain throbbed through my lip, and coppery blood spread across my tongue. I cursed and pushed myself up. Laughter arced over my head. Cliff pulled his foot back under the table. Then Miles rose from his seat and dragged Cliff out of his, slamming him back against the table. Rhea and the others cried out as their glasses rattled.
"What the hell is wrong with you?" Miles growled.
Every muscle in his hands and arms stood out, strained, his jaw tight. This was worse than yelling. This was even worse than in English class. His glasses had slipped down his nose, and he nailed Cliff to the table with an unrelenting stare.
"When are you going to stop? What did she do to you?"
"Chill out, Richter."
"You fucking chill out, Clifford."
Miles slammed him against the table again.
"If you've got a problem with anyone, it's me. So deal with me."
I stood, grabbing my water pitcher. "Miles, stop. He's not worth it. It's not a big deal." Miles's eyes flickered over to me.
"He hurt you."
I touched the spot on my lip where I'd bitten myself. My fingers came away bloody. "I'll be fine. I bit my lip. It was an accident." Miles looked less than thrilled, but he released Cliff.
"Damn, Richter. You know your girlfriend is screwy in the head, right?"
Cliff tugged on his collar.
"But I guess you're used to that, huh? I figure you like her because she reminds you of your dear old mutter."
He paused and folded his arms, getting a serious, concentrated look on his face.
"It's really kind of creepy when you think about it, because that means you want to fuck your mom."
I felt the shockwave move through the room. It started with Miles, knocking him slightly backward, seeming to ripple through every last inch of him. It silenced the rest of the restaurant. I saw Tucker in the far corner, forgetting that he was refilling someone's tea and letting the cup overflow. In the world of high school insults, it was actually pretty tame. But Miles's reaction made it terrible. Even Rhea seemed scared. The muscles in Miles's throat worked as though he was trying to speak or swallow, but his lips pressed together so tightly they turned white. He closed his eyes. "Miles?" I said. He exhaled sharply through his nose, opened his eyes, and reached out for me. Cliff punched him in the ear. Miles gasped and staggered to the side, clutching his head. I dropped the water pitcher and threw myself at Cliff before he could get another hit in. The next thing I knew, I had Rhea grabbing at my hair and shirt, and Cliff trying to pry me off. Then Art was there, holding off two other football players from joining the fray. And Jetta and the triplets and Tucker jumped in around him, trying to help me. And the whole place went to hell. Eventually, someone grabbed me underneath the arms and lifted me right out of the fight. I was set on my feet behind the counter and turned to see Gus. Big, pot-bellied Gus, the cigarette still clamped between his lips. He nodded, looking worried. Pitying. I hated that look. He trundled off to break up the fight, leaving a fuming Finnegan in his wake. Finnegan's face went from red to purple to white. Plates shattered. Drinks flew across the room. Blood dripped from my lip. Finnegan only got two words out before he apparently lost the ability to speak. "You're fired." Chapter 47. My mother was not amused. As soon as she saw my lip, she knew what had happened. Like Finnegan had some sort of telepathic link with her or something. Or, more likely, that Finnegan had a sister called the Gravedigger. She sat me in my room with my pictures and my artifacts, and she forced me to stay there for the rest of the night. Charlie kept me company, curled up in my lap, my arms around her. The gravity of the situation didn't hit me until Saturday afternoon when Miles showed up on the doorstep apologizing. "I didn't mean to get you fired," he said. I'd invited him in, but he still stood on the welcome mat outside the door, his hands stuffed in his pockets. Shadows ringed his eyes. A bruise was forming along his left cheekbone that may or may not have come from the fight at Finnegan's. "It's not your fault Cliff punched you in the ear," I said. "He's a 200-pound human wrecking ball. Did you really think I was going to stand there and wait for him to hit you again?" He stared at me. "The answer is no, you didn't, because no, I wasn't. Besides, Finnegan was going to find something to fire me for sooner or later. I'm glad it was something worth getting fired over." "I could have handled Cliff," Miles said. "I have some general experience getting the shit kicked out of me. But you needed that job." I wanted to argue with him, but sometimes he had a terrible way of being right. I hadn't just gotten fired. I'd gotten fired for starting a fight. So much for ever using Finnegan as a work reference. I glanced back into the house to make sure no one was listening, but Mom had gone to the store with Charlie, and Dad had fallen asleep reading a National Geographic on the couch. I stepped out onto the porch and closed the door behind me. "Well, it's too late now," I said, then offered up a pitiful smile. "But hey, that means I'll have more time to figure out what McCoy's doing, right?" I was joking, but Miles frowned. "You still want to break into his house?" "I have to figure out what's going on. As long as we don't get caught, it'll be fine." I was positive it would if Miles was still in on the plan. I waited, but his frown only deepened until he pushed his glasses up to rub at his eyes. "I remember lifting you up, you know," he finally said. "What?" "With the lobsters. I remember lifting you up. You were heavy." Thanks? He shook his head. "When are we doing this?"
"The day before the Spring Sports Awards."
"That's soon."
"I know. Tucker found out from the front desk secretary that McCoy is staying late that day for preparations, so we know he won't be home. I told my mom I'd have to go back to school to help the club set up the gym. I'd sneak out, but my parents have been watching me constantly. Miles exhaled sharply through his nose.
Okay, he said. Am I picking you up?
Tucker said he could, and we'd meet you there, since you already live so close.
Fine.
He hesitated a second, then turned to go. Wait! I caught his sleeve between my fingers. Are you angry? He only turned halfway back.
I'm a lot of things, he snapped. I don't know.
You could hang out here for a while. You don't have to go home.
I shouldn't, he began.
Then my mother's Forenza turned down the street and pulled into the driveway, boxing in Miles's truck. Charlie bounced in the passenger seat. My mother got out and called for help, bringing in the groceries.
Well,
he said, and I swear he sounded relieved.
I guess I could stay for a while.
Chapter 48.
The day before the Spring Sports Awards, Tucker picked me up just as the shadows of the trees began slanting the other direction. I ran out to his SUV as fast as I could, ignoring the perimeter check so my mother wouldn't have time to see who was driving. The Hannibal's Rest Phoenix soared overhead. I didn't mention it to Tucker. I didn't need anything, right? I asked, checking myself over. Converse, jeans, striped T-shirt.
Nope. Richter said he knows a quick way in.
Tucker pulled out of the driveway and started toward Lakeview. Why do you still call him Richter? You've called him Miles before. Tucker shrugged.
Habit, I guess. I don't know if I'll ever be able to call him anything else.
We made it to Lakeview in 10 minutes. Tucker passed Miles's street and went two more, to a cul-de-sac where rainbows and unicorns came to die. Miles's truck was already parked along the curb. Tucker pulled up behind it and pointed to a house a little farther down.
That's his.
The place had probably looked good once, but now unchecked ivy grew up its sides. The house must have been red and white, but the white was peeling and yellowed and the red had been bleached to a Pepto-Bismol pink. We got out and met Miles.
He hasn't been home since I've been here, said Miles.
How long do you think we have? I asked.
An hour. Evan and Ian said they could hold McCoy at school until at least 4. Should be plenty.
Are you sure we can get in? Tucker asked. Miles scoffed.
Have some faith, Beaumont. I got into your house, didn't I?
Tucker rolled his eyes.
Fine, then. Lead on.
The two of them started down the sidewalk. But as soon as I took a step, a flash of red behind the driver's seat in Tucker's SUV caught my eye. I looked back, wondering if it was some sort of hallucination, and then realized I knew that shade of red. Hold on. The two of them stopped as I marched back to the SUV and threw open the back door. Charlie crouched in between the seats, curled so tightly I hadn't seen her there on the drive over. She stared at me. Eyes wide and frightened. The Black King was in one curled fist, shiny with spit and dented with teeth marks. Charlie!
Sorry, she whined. I thought you were going to your school and I wanted to see it. You never take me anywhere with you.
I tugged on my hair.
Seriously? Ugh, I can't take you home now. Let me come with you.
She tried to jump out of the car. I shoved her back into the SUV. I didn't want her walking around in the middle of the crappy side of Lakeview Trail.
Where are we? She asked.
Stay here. Are you listening to me? Do not leave this car. I fixed her with my most searing gaze. Do not leave this spot. Got it? She nodded, but still tried to get a better look outside. I got the feeling that she hadn't actually heard a word I'd said.
What is it?
Miles called. I pointed a warning finger at Charlie and slammed the door closed. She sat back in the seat and crossed her arms, pouting.
Charlie hitched a ride, I said. I never even saw her get in. I told her to stay put while we're in there.
Miles and Tucker glanced at each other, but said nothing. We walked up to McCoy's front door. I did my perimeter check, glancing back at the SUV to make sure Charlie didn't sneak out. Miles went straight for a ledge created by the edge of the porch roof. He felt around for a second, then pulled down a key.
"How'd you know that was there?"
Tucker asked. Miles shrugged.
"He probably has them all over the place."
He kicked the welcome mat aside, and there was another key underneath.
"See?"
He kicked the mat back in place, then unlocked the door and pulled it open. Inside, the smell of mustiness coated everything like a thick layer of bad cologne. Tucker sneezed. Miles closed the door behind us.
"It looks so normal," Tucker said.
We passed a staircase and went into a dining room lined with cabinets. "Maybe for a retired octogenarian," I said. Antique furniture filled every available inch of space, some of it broken, and some of it in usable condition. I thought I saw a World War II gas mask wedged between a broken scale and a worn cookie tin, but I grabbed Miles's hand and told myself that it wasn't really there. We scoured the entire lower level of the house, from the dining room to a narrow, dirty kitchen, to a living room with the ugliest orange shag carpet I'd ever seen in my life. For half a second, I was tempted to leave McCoy a handwritten note, expressing my profound and sincere astonishment that he had the balls to keep such a carpet in his home. Nothing seemed out of the ordinary, except for the gas mask and a few magnets shaped like swastikas on the refrigerator. "I haven't seen anything," I said.
"No," Tucker shrugged. "But they're still upstairs."
I turned toward the staircase again and saw a flash of red.
"Charlie!" I hissed, darting after her. I knew I shouldn't have trusted her to stay in that car. She was too much like me to stay put.
She froze halfway up the stairs, looking back.
"I told you to stay in the car," I said.
"But I want to help," she cried, stomping her foot.
"Get down here right now."
"No."
"Charlemagne?
You sound like Mom." She charged the rest of the way up the stairs. I ran after her. Miles and Tucker were right behind me. I shouldered open the door Charlie had gone through. And then I froze.
"Look at all the dresses," Charlie crooned.
The room was a museum exhibit. Dresses, prom, homecoming, cocktail, formal, even wedding, were displayed on mannequins. The mannequins all wore blonde wigs. Plastered on the walls behind them were pictures upon pictures upon pictures, all of one person. Scarlet. My stomach lurched. These could be my walls. There was a large wooden desk on the far side of the room, strewn with papers and more pictures and frames. A pair of silver heels sat on the corner.
"What the actual fuck?"
Tucker walked in, then Miles a moment later. I put an arm around Charlie and moved her behind me as Tucker, Miles, and I moved to search through the papers on the desk. There were all sorts of things. Bills, official-looking documents from school, taxes that hadn't been filed yet, a half-completed crossword puzzle.
"This is all just junk,"
Tucker grumbled, picking up a stack of blank printer paper. It didn't even look like McCoy had a computer, much less a printer.
"Keep looking," I said. "There's got to be something."
I grabbed the corner of a photograph and slid it out of the mess, careful not to dislodge anything else. It was a picture of Celia and an older, dark-haired man with an arm around her shoulders. Both of them were smiling. Celia's father, maybe? The man's eyes had been burned out, the edges of his face crinkled and red. Why would McCoy burn Celia's father's eyes out? Why would he burn anyone's eyes out? How could anyone go this far down the rabbit hole without realizing they needed help? And more importantly, what would he do if he found us here, looking through his things? I stuffed the picture back where I'd found it, grabbed Miles and Tucker and pushed them both toward the door. We needed to get out of here, now. We're not going to find anything else. Let's go. Eyes peeked out of the dark space under the desk. Charlie! Come on! No one asked any questions. Miles pulled the key from his pocket and locked the front door behind us.
Uh-oh, Tucker said.
McCoy's junker of a car trundled down the street. Miles shoved the key above the doorframe, then grabbed us both and yanked us off the porch. He pushed Tucker and me behind the dead shrubs that hugged the side of McCoy's house, then ducked in after us. Sharp branches dug into my arms and head, and sweat trickled down my neck. McCoy pulled into his driveway, got out of his car, and went inside.
"Is he gone?"
Miles whispered. His neck cranked toward me so the shrubs didn't poke his eyes out. "Yeah," I said. As quietly as possible, we climbed out of the shrubs and dashed for Miles' truck and Tucker's SUV. Charlie wasn't behind me. I jerked to a halt, pulling Miles with me.
"What? What is it?"
he asked. "Charlie! Where'd Charlie go?" I looked around, back to McCoy's house. "She came out with us, didn't she? You saw her come out."
"Alex."
Miles pulled me forward. "Miles, if she's still in that house, we have to go back." He kept pulling. I dug my heels in. Stupid, stupid Charlie had to follow us. I couldn't believe her. I knew she was only 8, but I couldn't believe she could be this stupid. Miles grabbed my shoulders and dragged me to the cars, swung me around so I was pinned between him and his truck. Tucker stood behind him, his face twisted with that awful pity.
"Alex?"
Miles' voice was low but forceful. His bright blue eyes pierced me.
"Charlie's not real."
"Why did you leave?"
Chapter 49. The world tipped sideways.
What?
I stuttered.
"Charlie's not real. There's no one there. There never was."
Miles pulled me around to the other side of his truck. The words buzzed in my ears, and everything stopped. The wind stopped rustling the trees. Even the bug on Miles's windshield froze in its tracks.
"No!"
I tore my arm from Miles's grasp. Shock radiated out through my limbs.
"No! You're lying! She was there! She was right there!"
I'd seen her leave the house with us, I was sure.
"Don't lie to me, Miles! Don't you fucking lie!"
"He's not lying."
Tucker came around on my other side, his hands up.
"She's real, Tucker. She's gotta be..."
I looked toward McCoy's again, expecting Charlie to pop out from the other side of the house, playing a game. I'd yell at her for scaring me, and I wouldn't let her out of my sight again until we got home. But she didn't appear.
"Go home, Beaumont," Miles said to Tucker. "I'll take care of her."
"Alex?"
Tucker said again, moving closer to me. I stepped away, wiping my eyes. I couldn't cry. Charlie wasn't here. She was at home. But the more I wiped my eyes, the more tears spilled out. Home. I had to go home. I climbed into the passenger seat of Miles's truck, buckled myself in. Home.
"It'll be okay."
Tucker leaned through the window, holding my hand and speaking softly. What was okay? Miles's door slammed. The truck roared to life. Tucker slipped away with the rest of the scenery. Miles kept talking to me, but I couldn't hear what he said. She was just there. She had always been there. The front door slammed against the hallway wall when I threw it open. My parents were at the kitchen table, eating dinner, like nothing was wrong. Their heads shot up when I appeared in the doorway. I suddenly realized I couldn't breathe.
"Charlie!"
I choked out. My mother stood first. She still had her napkin clutched in one hand, and she came at me with it like I was a baby who'd spit up. I backed away from her.
Why didn't you tell me?
Alex, honey.
How can she not be real?
A whimper came from behind me. Charlie stood in the hallway, her chess set held in both trembling hands. It was the chess set she'd had to get new black pawns for because I'd flushed all the old ones down the toilet. One of the pawns was wedged between her teeth. When she whimpered again, it fell out of her mouth.
"What's going on, Alex?"
Charlie asked, her voice shaking as much as her hands.
"What are you talking about?" "Charlie?"
A knot formed in my throat. My vision blurred again.
But I remember you bringing her home from the hospital, feeding her and taking care of her and watching her grow up, and she always had Christmas presents under the tree, and you always set a place for her at the table. And she has to be...
She was real, my mother said. Her voice had gone tight, strained in a way I'd never heard it before. But she died 4 years ago. Dad stood up as well. I didn't like that everyone was standing.
Charlie died before she turned 5.
Dad's voice broke.
Asphyxiation,
he said.
I should never have let her play with my chess set.
I backed away, shielding Charlie from view. She whimpered again. The chessboard tumbled from her hands, and now all the other pieces joined the black pawn on the floor.
I'm calling Leanne.
My mother went for the phone.
We shouldn't have waited so long. This has gone too far. There's got to be a stronger medication she can prescribe.
She doesn't need a stronger medication.
A hand wrapped around my arm. Miles stood where Charlie had just been, glaring at my mother. Anger radiated off him, deep and cold.
She needs parents who give a shit about telling her what's real and what's not.
My parents stared at him, both of them rooted to the spot, and completely silent.
Miles,
I whispered.
How could you not tell her?
He got louder by the second.
Charlie's been dead for years, and you think it's okay to pretend she's not? Did you think Alex wouldn't find out? Was she too crazy for that?
No, it's nothing like...
my mother began.
Like what? What could justify that?
Miles's fingers dug into my arm.
It better be pretty damn good, because that's fucked up. That's really fucked up. You're the ones she's supposed to be able to trust. You're supposed to be the ones she can go to when she can't tell. But instead, she has to take a bunch of pictures, because if she tells you anything, you threaten to send her to an asylum.
Tears filled my mother's eyes.
You have no right to come in my house and tell me how to treat my daughter.
Oh, really? Because I know terrible parents, and you're one of them.
We tried,
Dad finally said, his voice barely above a whisper.
We tried to tell her. Alex was in the hospital at the time. She'd just had an episode. She wasn't doing well. And no matter what we said, it just rolled off.
He looked at me.
Like you couldn't hear us. At first we thought you were just in shock. We thought you understood. But then you came home and you were talking to her and we realized that you didn't.
The room was too small, too close, too hot. An awful sob escaped my throat before I could catch it. I clapped my hand over my mouth. It seemed to break Miles's anger. His face rearranged itself into a soft expression of pity that I hated. I didn't want that look from anyone, least of all Miles. Never him. I darted across the kitchen to the back door. I could hardly see, but I knew exactly where I was going. I wrenched the door open, tripped down the steps, and sprinted across the backyard. When I got to Redwich Bridge, I slid down the embankment of the creek and climbed under the bridge where no one could see me. My lungs burned, and my eyes stung from the tears.
blue eyes. Bloody Miles, Scarlet, the Eight Ball, and now Charlie? Charlie. Charlemagne, my own sister. If Charlie wasn't real, then what was? Was everything made up? Was this whole world inside my head? If I ever woke up from it, would I be inside a padded room somewhere, drooling all over myself? Would I even be myself? Charlie had been a constant. Never once had I suspected she wasn't real. She'd always been real. Soft and warm, and there when I needed her. I couldn't breathe. I pressed a hand to my stomach and sucked in air, but bile rose to block it. My throat closed up.
Alex. Alex, calm down.
Miles slid down the embankment, planted himself in front of me, and grabbed my shoulders.
Breathe. Just breathe. Relax.
He took my hand and pressed it to his chest, over his heart. It beat frantically under my palm. Was that real? His heart? Was he real? I stared back at the blue eyes I'd always thought were too good to be true. So were they? Was Miles real? Because if Charlie wasn't real and he wasn't real, I didn't want this anymore. I didn't want any of it.
Hey.
Are you real? I asked.
Yes, I am, he said resolutely.
He pressed my hand harder to his chest. His heart beat like a drum.
I am real. This?
He put his other hand over the first.
Is real. You see me interacting with other people all day long, don't you? I talk to people. I affect things in the world. I cause things to happen. I am real.
But what if this whole place... I had to suck in air again. What if everything is inside my head? East Shoal and Scarlet and this bridge and you. What if you're not real because nothing is real?
If nothing's real, then does it matter? He said. You live here. Doesn't that make it real enough?
Chapter 50. Miles and I sat under Red Witch Bridge until darkness settled in for good around us. My parents hadn't come looking for me. I guess they knew I wouldn't go far. Or they had amazing faith in Miles's ability to find me. Or maybe they didn't want to face either of us. At the house, the kitchen light was still on. I stopped in the backyard, taking a long minute to search the area. It seemed stupid now, but I couldn't stop myself. I turned slowly on the spot. House, door, street, woods. We went in through the front door. I closed it loud enough to make sure my parents knew we were back. I didn't want another confrontation. I didn't want Miles and my mother going at each other's throats again. I did another perimeter check in my room. Opened one of my photo albums on the dresser. It was all Charlie. Charlie smiling. Charlie playing chess. Charlie asleep with her violin tucked under her arm. I showed Miles the album. What do you see? He flipped through a few pages.
Furniture? Your backyard, your kitchen, the street. What should I see?
I took the album back from him, closed it, and set it on the dresser. No medicine would ever be strong enough for this. Miles glanced at the clock on my nightstand. It was almost 1 in the morning. Will your dad be angry? I asked.
Probably. He gets angry about everything.
Over his shoulder, I got a glimpse of white and red. Bloody Miles stood in the corner, grinning at me with his stained teeth. I squeezed my eyes shut. Do you have to go?
Are you okay?
He brushed my arm. I opened my eyes.
I'm fine. I'm good. I turned back toward the bed and the window. Charlie stood outside, a horrible, sad grimace on her face. All 16 black chess pieces stuck out of her mouth like finely carved tumors. I gasped and jumped. Miles's arms came around me.
What do you see?
Charlie's at the window, and you're in the corner?
Me?
I nodded. From Celia's bonfire. Please don't ask.
I can stay.
I nodded. I pushed open his arms and walked to the closet, opening the door in bloody Miles's face. I peeled my shirt and jeans off and put on my pajamas. Miles sat on the edge of the bed and took off his shoes.
Your parents?
He asked. We're not doing anything.
Besides, they might not be real. I think your mom hates me,
he said. I kind of hate her, I said, realizing with a jolt that I meant it. She needed to hear that. Thank you for telling her. I closed the closet door. Bloody Miles's foul breath fanned over my ear and cheek. I pulled away from him and slid past Miles into the bed. He lay down and slung an arm over my waist. I didn't know how to position myself. Facing away from him, Charlie stared at me through the window. Facing him, bloody Miles loomed overhead. I turned to the pillow, eyes shut. This wasn't real. They weren't real. Miles pressed up against me and buried his face in my hair. He could say he didn't understand emotions all he wanted, but sometimes it felt like he understood them better than anyone else I knew. The hard ridge of his glasses pressed into my temple. I liked the pressure. It reminded me that he was there. Miles?
Yeah?
Don't go away.
I won't.
Chapter 51. Morning sunlight crept into the room, lighting up my artifacts and the freckles on Miles's face. The sheets were tangled around us. One of his hands was curled in my shirt, warm against my stomach, and the other was tucked beneath his chin. The rise of his body blocked most of the room, so I had to peek slowly over him to check the surroundings. Bloody Miles was gone. So was Charlie. I stopped the thought as soon as I noticed it creeping up on me and allowed it to get no farther than that. Charlie was gone. No amount of hoping or wishing would bring her back. Not really. The door opened a crack. My mother. I met her eye, expecting her to barge in, to yell at us, to put me under house arrest for lying to her yesterday, for running out so late, for letting Miles sleep in my room. But she didn't. She nodded and turned away. Miles sighed. His glasses were askew on his nose. I didn't want to wake him up, but I also didn't want to be alone. I kissed his cheekbone. He sighed again. I huffed and said, "Miles." He grunted, cracking his eyes open. "Morning," I said.
"How did you sleep?"
he asked. "Okay, I guess." I wouldn't have slept at all if he hadn't stayed awake until I drifted off. The night was a blur now. I couldn't remember any dreams, just flashes of red hair and chess pieces, wisps of violin music. You?
Better than usual.
I reached up to fix his glasses. He smiled a little. Do we have to go to school today? I asked. Can we at least skip the awards?
The awards are the one thing we have to go to, he said. I have to be there for the club. And if you don't go, you'll be violating your community service.
But McCoy will be there. I don't want you near him. McCoy will burn his eyes out.
If we don't go, McCoy will have a reason to call me to his office. Then he'll have me alone, and it'll be even worse.
God, he was humoring me, and I couldn't stop myself. Then you have to stay away from him. Don't let him anywhere near you. Don't even let him look at you.
I know.
His fist pressed into my stomach.
I know. If I looked at him any longer, I was going to start crying.